The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, tonight, I thought we could take a look at compassion, equanimity, and wisdom. And in particular, how compassion and equanimity interrelate at a given time in someone's practice, and how they work together on this path to develop a heart that has deep wisdom. Equanimity and compassion are both very beautiful mind states. They're two of what's called the Brahma Viharas, which are restful mind states, and if I'm allowed to use this word, they're considered divine mind states, really excellent emotions and intentions. Compassion is sometimes called the jewel in the lotus, where the lotus symbolizes the developed mind or heart that blossoms in freedom, and the compassion is the jewel in the center. Compassion is one of the most beautiful feelings that a person can experience, and it's considered a form of inner wealth and a source of happiness for us. And then equanimity is just a deeply pure state of mind, a mind that's in perfect balance, if you will. And it's a very subtle and exquisite experience. And when the two of these work together, they're powerful forces for alleviating suffering. That is, for walking the path. As often happens on this path, though, we're going to begin with the suffering after that taste of the beauty that's possible. There's definitely plenty of suffering in the world. I think we all have a sense of that. We may simply feel compassion for a friend who's going through a hard time, or for ourselves if we're feeling very busy and sort of overwrought with our lives. And then we look out into the world and we see wars, floods, economic crises, environmental destruction, oppressive dictatorships. And we may feel some pull to help in any way that we can when we see this, when we witness this suffering. But we may also fear drowning if we really open to all the suffering that's potentially there. Can we really handle all the suffering in the world? So equanimity and compassion work together to help us navigate through the suffering of our lives and that we see in the world so that we can act skillfully. And that means not shutting down or denying, and also not drowning in getting too involved. And what's true out there is also true in here for the suffering that we may meet in our hearts as we practice. That same balance of compassion and equanimity will guide us toward opening our heart and to freeing ourselves from the suffering that's there. So compassion and equanimity that are united have the potential to bring about deep wisdom. Compassion is sometimes likened to empathy. Certainly empathy is a component of it, but compassion is a bit more than empathy, than feeling with the suffering of others. It includes with it the desire to help, to in some way alleviate that suffering. Thich Nhat Hanh says that compassion is a verb, and so it's some kind of, it implies the action that goes with it. And interestingly, although compassion is directly connected with suffering, it's not a painful state. It's not the same as feeling distress at another person's suffering. It's important to be clear about that in our own mind, is that when someone is suffering and we feel like we're suffering along with them and are feeling distressed about that, we've turned a little bit from the purity of that's possible from compassion. And we'll look at that a little bit more. Joseph Goldstein says, "Compassion is the strong and deep feeling that wants to alleviate the suffering of beings. And it arises when we allow ourselves to come close to suffering, both our own and that of others. This is a profound and difficult practice. Just as we don't like to be with our own pain, we don't necessarily want to be with the pain of others. Strong tendencies of the mind often keep us defensive or indifferent or apathetic in the face of suffering. It's also possible to sentimentalize and idealize compassion and then simply become content with the idea of compassion. Or we may judge ourselves for not having enough of it, or take a subtle pride in our more compassionate moments." So then it's helpful to actively develop and purify this wholesome quality, given in light of what Goldstein says. The process begins by genuinely valuing compassion and reflecting on its benefits and intending to develop it. There has to be some kind of a movement from within us. And it's also quite important when developing compassion not to have a feeling of obligation. You know, I'm doing this because I should, because my mother said it was good to help people, because that's what I think it means to be a good Buddhist. Things like that can slip in. But instead to have more of a sense of generosity, and especially that it's flowing freely from a safe place within us. It's very helpful to feel that we are somehow safe or secure even before we begin to offer this kind of service to others. And with these various conditions in place, then compassion can begin to flower more. So part of developing compassion is to strengthen it. You know, that's the part of us that wants to turn away from suffering and doesn't necessarily want to look at that. So we have some interest in strengthening the quality. And then part is also to purify it, to be alert in particular for what's called the near enemy of compassion. And that means something that is similar to it, looks like it, maybe from the outside, but is not quite it. It's where it's been mixed with something else. And often, what that means for compassion is that it turns into what's called pity. When we observe other people suffering, pity would be compassion that's mixed with fear, for example. So it's something like, "I'm sorry for your pain, and I'm pretty sure it won't happen to me." And so, you know, there's this sense of somehow having that thought in the back of our mind, how can I avoid this? Now that I'm seeing that you're going through this, I wonder how I can not do that myself. It can be helpful to reflect on our lack of control in many ways. That can be helpful. If we're reflecting on people who are inflicting suffering, an especially difficult group to have compassion for, but if you're doing that advanced practice, then pity can be compassion that's mixed with anger. So I wish your suffering would end so that you wouldn't hurt others, which is something that I would never do. Right, so this, again, there's a little bit of a separation there. We can reflect that this person is us in some way. You know, we have that tendency in us too, which is why we can recognize it in them. Yeah? So it's helpful to break down that connection also. And for people who are very close to us that we're feeling compassion for, compassion can get mixed with attachment. I wish your pain would end, and I'm really invested in that happening. And, you know, of course we want their pain to end. That's the wholesome part. But when there's a lot of investment in that and we suffer a lot if it's not happening, then we're not able to be as truly present for that person as they may need us to be in their suffering. Out in the world, compassion is sometimes called compassionate action. That's a phrase that you'll hear. Although somehow, in a way, I think compassion must imply the action. It's a little bit of a double term. But it can look a lot of different ways. It could be as personal as keeping the precepts or caring for a family member. Or it could be more public, in the political or social sphere, or taking environmental action, somehow informed by Buddhist values. It's important not to get caught in particular views of what compassion can look like, and instead to feel in ourselves what feels most appropriate for the way that we think, way that we are moved to act in relieving suffering. It can be very soft. Maybe we've experienced compassion that is very soft, feels caring, feels warm and fuzzy in many ways. And it can also be fierce. There are, maybe not so much in our tradition, but there are, maybe in our tradition, there are often examples of fierce compassion by Buddhist teachers or others who are offering strong lessons in what it means to really be free from suffering. I'm thinking of the story of a friend who wanted to help Buddhist nuns who are in not as good of a position as Buddhist monks usually. And she thought about taking some fairly strong action toward allowing the full ordination of Buddhist nuns, but she had some hesitance about how to do that or whether she would be able to. And her teacher, who was also a monastic, said very strongly, "You must do this or you cannot call me teacher anymore." And he said it fairly fiercely. I'm not able to imitate that voice tonight, I'm sorry. But it was a very powerful statement for her, and it sort of cut right through the wavering and the doubt that she felt, and she suddenly was able to connect with the fierceness in herself of really wanting to help in this way. And it was skillfully done. It's because he knew she had that ability, but the doubt was kind of coloring that and covering over her ability to see that she had that. So compassion can indeed be fierce. Joan Halifax, who is a Zen teacher who does a lot of hospice work, says that compassion is like having a soft front and a strong back. Does that image make sense? So we have an uprightness. There's definitely something solid keeping us alert and upright. But it has this very soft front that it meets the world with and has a tenderness to it, supported by the strength of our practice. This is what she claims is needed to work with something like dying people, you know, some kind of a powerful spiritual experience, and to be able to be effective in that situation. Along the course of developing compassion, one way that people trip up is through what's been called idiot compassion. And this means compassion that is not informed by wisdom, essentially. So this can result in doing what is not actually helpful. For example, a friend of mine who is a hospice volunteer was at somebody's house, and she was just supposed to be there for a few hours and, you know, relieve the caregiver so the person could go out and do some shopping or have some time off. And she noticed that in the kitchen, all the dirty dishes were piled in the sink. And she thought, oh, I'll be helpful and I'll just wash all these dishes. So she just did that. And then when the person came home, they were shocked and surprised. They had some reason why they needed those dishes not to be done right away. And so her sort of compassion of seeing what she thought needed to be done actually wasn't helpful in that situation. You can't necessarily know, but this is, she applied what she thought was the right thing to do, and it wasn't necessarily. We'll run into this a lot as we're trying to develop this quality because, you know, we don't necessarily know how we can serve. Idiot compassion can also result in a lot of personal misery in the sense that if we're working too hard and really just trying to be compassionate, giving, serving, doing everything that we can experience burnout, overwhelm in some way, and that's also not a wise way to approach compassion, to overgive, if you will. So there's some wisdom in knowing how much we're able to do at a given time. So what we're moving toward is the notion that compassion needs to be informed or balanced by wisdom, or to take a preliminary step, by equanimity, by something that is has more balance or even-mindedness to it, that's not only on the emotionally responsive level. So equanimity does mean even-mindedness. It's an sort of an unshakable balance of mind that we can bring into situations. We're not overpowered by delusions, by mental dullness, by agitation. In particular, we're not swayed by what are called the eight worldly winds, which are gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute, and praise and blame. I won't go through all of those, but I think we can feel for ourselves that those are factors in our lives that come and go, and as much as we scramble around trying to put everything in place so that the unpleasant ones don't happen and the pleasant ones do, it's not always successful. A Theravadan monk called Jnanaponikatera said, "We feel how our heart responds to all of this, that is, these eight worldly winds, with happiness and sorrow, delight and despair, disappointment and satisfaction, hope and fear. These waves of emotion carry us up and fling us down, and no sooner do we find rest than we are in the power of a new wave again. We can only remain steady if we have sufficient equanimity." So it's kind of a ballast, if you will, for our emotions, something that helps balance them out. So kind of the opposite of equanimity would be emotional reactivity, craving, and the anxiety that we feel when we're spending a lot of time judging and dividing people into good and bad. Those are kind of the opposite. But then equanimity, like compassion, has a near enemy, and that's usually called indifference. And equanimity, when it's described as this kind of balance and not reacting, is that people can think, oh, it's cold aloofness or detachment in some way. But instead, it's more like regarding everyone, friend or enemy or someone we don't know, as equal in a certain way, equally deserving of our attention, equally deserving of our compassion. Seeing all of experience as worthy of practice, everything is worthy of being our teacher. Equanimity also definitely needs development in our heart. And one way I'd like to suggest, one way that I work with, is to develop it by challenging our current level of equanimity, by greater exposure to suffering or to situations where we know we have a tendency to cling or react. So kind of deliberately pushing on our edge from a safe place. So we learn to be with more and more challenging situations, developing a strength of heart that can handle more and more things. That's usually how it unfolds. Sometimes we, the way I'm speaking about it implies that we might do this with difficult or painful things. I would add that it could be very joyous and sensual and pleasant experiences also. We might get easily caught up and carried away in experiences that are pleasant. And it's just as important to learn to be equanimous and mindful and calm in a celebration as in a war zone. So that can be an interesting place of practice. It's fun, too, because you'll get to go to parties and things like that and try to be equanimous while you're there. So what does equanimity, all this equanimity, have to do with compassion and compassionate action? If we see suffering and we're not supposed to react to it, but we're moved to help, how do those combine in a certain way? If we're moved to help through compassion, where's there room for equanimity in that? Well, equanimity is what supplies the wisdom so that we're not doing the idiot compassion. And it's said, actually, that wisdom and compassion are the two wings to awakening. So you can imagine a bird trying to fly with only one wing, kind of just keeps going in a circle. But when you have two of them, then can really take off. So the same monk I quoted from before, Nyanaponika Thera, wrote a very nice piece of where he kind of compares different Brahmaviharas, of which compassion and equanimity are two of them, two of these divine mind states. And he compares them nicely with how they kind of play off each other. He says, compassion guards equanimity from falling into a cold indifference, and it keeps it from indolent or selfish isolation. Until equanimity has reached perfection, compassion urges it again and again to enter the battle of the world in order to be able to stand the test by hardening and strengthening itself. Equanimity rooted in insight is the guiding and restraining power for compassion. Equanimity guards compassion from being dissipated in vain quests and from going astray in the labyrinths of uncontrolled emotion. Equanimity furnishes compassion with an even, unwavering courage and fearlessness, enabling it to face the awesome abyss of misery and despair which confront boundless compassion again and again. To the active side of compassion, equanimity is the calm and firm hand led by wisdom, indispensable to those who want to practice the difficult art of helping others. So one way I've been working with this is that I, over the last year, I participated in the Sati Center's Buddhist Chaplaincy Training Program, which is a wonderful program that helps train a bit in learning how to serve as a chaplain, and that's normally a Christian term, so it's a little bit defining what that means for a Buddhist. But essentially, chaplains go and meet people in the world at the places where they're at in some kind of distress. So they go out into the field and confront the suffering there, meet it there, meet people where they are. And one way that we do that is through the program is that we volunteer in a particular place, and I was volunteering in a hospital. And I'll just describe one encounter, not in great detail, but enough to give some shape to it. So I was volunteering in the rehabilitation unit of the hospital, and that means that people tend to be there for a while, longer than they are in the regular part of the hospital. So for a while, there was a room that I just sort of never got to. It was darkened and the curtains were drawn and there tended to be people in there. But eventually, I did go into it. It had probably been a couple of weeks. And there I found the patient was actually asleep, but I encountered the patient's wife who just seemed to be drawn in on herself a bit and described what was really a heartbreaking situation in that, just as an overview, it had been a long illness and had developed into different things than they expected. And despite, and you know, on top of this, there were some issues going on in their lives where because the patient was out of the workforce, they had were having financial difficulties, and there was the possibility of eviction. And in the meantime, their daughter was graduating from high school, but they weren't able to be there for it. And it just kind of went on like this. And I felt my heart really at first opening, but also breaking. I was almost crying listening to this woman, just being present for her. And I turned, at one point, I turned my attention in. I felt it was important to really be mindful of my own feelings so that I could feel that and be able to be with her in the most wise way. And I turned my attention directly to this feeling of helplessness that was arising in me from listening to all this. And it was very fruitful. It was sort of like a water slide. I felt this compassion flood through my body, and I suddenly felt that her pain was my pain, was all of humanity's pain in a way. I mean, this situation could happen to any of us, really. Maybe we know someone even who it's something like that has happened to. And I felt the unpredictability of life and the impermanence of everything in the face of illness. At the same time, though, I was aware that there was this, somewhere within me, there was this ballast. You know, I was feeling this emotion. I was feeling tears in my eyes. But there was something within me that was kind of hanging on the other side of that, like a strong weight. And at that moment, I feel that there was a real sense of both the compassion and the equanimity. I felt that balance, that ballast directly. It doesn't always come together quite that well, but when it did in a case like this, it was very insightful, powerful experience. So when compassion and equanimity are both strong, they're both strongly developed, they both happen to be present at the same time, then the mind can move swiftly toward freedom. And there's this there's a teacher, Catherine McGee, who teaches at Gaia House in the UK, who has a beautiful way of talking about this. She says that this balance is her conception of the middle way, what it means to have the middle way. And I want to read a little bit of what she said. She also brings in the deep wisdom of non-self into what she says about compassion and equanimity, which she uses different terms for. She says, "I see the middle way as the marriage of objectivity and sensitivity. Clear seeing, that would be the equanimity, the vipassana, together with what is sensitive, intimate, and tangible." So the real sensations of our body, of our mind, of our feelings, seen with this very pure wisdom, objectivity and sensitivity. And she goes on to say, "I have done environmental work, and even with the wholesome idea of caring for the environment, we can still conceive of ourselves as separate. I am going to care for the environment out there. This is dukkha." I'm quoting her again. "In fact, trying to think about caring for the environment is too big, too much to handle. If we really take it in, we feel helpless, or we get pushed into trying to save the world, and both are misery. The climate crisis can lead us toward awakening simply because I can't do it. The path of awakening is not separate from turning toward the climate issue. It requires this marriage of objectivity and sensitivity. We need a middle way attitude that could be expressed as, this is completely beyond me, but I'm still here. It may not be me and mine, but it's not other than me and mine either." So I like this way of seeing it, of pointing directly toward that intimate, tender feeling of being directly connected to experience, and yet not swept away by it, right there for it, but seeing it clearly. That's this compassion and equanimity working together. And it leads us toward a different kind of development. Christina Feldman says, there are two ways to view compassion. One is as a heart quality to be developed, and the other is as the expression of wisdom. Compassion is the natural expression of wisdom because wisdom means understanding the Four Noble Truths, and in particular, the first truth, that suffering pervades normal human experience. As one becomes more selfless, that is, more wise, there is less or no differentiation between their suffering and my suffering. Their and my, in quotes. So, this is interesting, right? It's pointing toward the need to develop these two in tandem, I think. And many people, maybe even most in their own practice, will at some point run into the question of how to balance service in the world or service in some way with their own inner development, right? I'm sitting on the cushion, so I'm not out there helping people. Or I'm out there helping people, but I'm suffering for it. I wish I were wiser about it. How can I get more cushion time? How can I do these together or something? I think one way to see it is to undertake both, as Catherine McGee was pointing toward. So I like to call this the iterative path. So it's one in which it's sometimes engaged in deep inner work with little interaction with the outside world, and sometimes engaged more actively with the world. And the insights that we have on the cushion can then inform our ability and motivation to act externally. And then these worldly actions develop the heart qualities that will allow us to go deeper into meditation. It's certainly true, I've seen that the stronger the heart is from its, interaction with the world in a way, its sensitivity in meeting the world, that develops the strength which then applies on the cushion also and can take us deeper into meditation, deeper into our seclusion from the world. Back and forth, slowly working the mind into a state of purity. So this maybe gives a deeper understanding of why the Buddha called wisdom and compassion the two wings to awakening. Because the deepest compassion contains the wish to alleviate the deepest suffering, the suffering of the sense of self, that is to walk a path of wisdom. So the deepest compassion leads us to walk a path of wisdom, and the deepest wisdom manifests as this compassion in the world. So may these two wings of awakening carry you off into the sky. Thank you.